Hi there. This is Long John Neville. In the brief period of time available on the two sides of this disc, I'm going to bring to you a picture of one of the most unbelievable things to occur in the 20th century. The fantastic phenomenon of madness, or soul-shaking prophecy of hope or horror. Events which shook this country and most of the rest of the world. It was, of course, the age of flying saucers. Very possibly the most amazing phenomenon in the history of modern times. Sightings of spacecraft from other planets, even other galaxies. Telepathic or mechanical contact with these occupants of these ships. Meetings and speaking with people from other planets. Trips to the other planets in flying saucers, and even wilder. These were but a few of the amazing claims made by the men who created the hypnotic rage of flying saucers and UFOs. I don't buy any of it. But I'll say that only once. From this point forward, you make up your own mind. According to Englishman Desmond Leslie, the first interplanetary traveler, a visitor from Venus appeared on Earth 18,617,841 B.C. Others, like the late scholar Morris K. Jessup, dated the origin of UFOs from biblical times. But in terms of this modern era, it all began with a flying businessman named Kenneth Arnold, who on June 24th, 1947, spotted 9 disks near Mount Rainier. Now, when interviewed about this sighting, he reported that they seemed to skip across the sky like flying saucers. Following this now historical Arnold episode came the tragic affair of the Goodman Field Air Base in Kentucky, when Captain Thomas Mantell, United States Air Force, was sent up to investigate a crimson saucer. Still climbing at 10,000 feet, the captain radioed that it, to quote, looks metallic and it's tremendous. I'm going to 20,000 feet. And that was the last ever heard of Mantell. He disappeared into the clouds and moments later crashed to Earth and was killed. According to one Air Force release, the tragedy had occurred as a result of Captain Mantell's attempt to reach Venus. Yes, you may say that's pretty wild. And of course, there are many, many other things that have happened during this period. Then came the Gorman case. The plane of a North Dakota George Gorman who was repeatedly attacked by a light. During this period, as other sightings piled up, the Air Force established a number of agencies to investigate these extraordinary happenings. But things had only begun to pop. Now opened the era of the contactees. That is, people who claimed that saucers had landed and that they had made contact with the actual occupants. Among the first important of these contactees was Dan Fry. His initial experience took place on the 4th of July back in the year of 1950 at the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico. He met a voice. This is Dan.
I was sent to the White Sands Proving Grounds to set up instrumentation for the testing of some very large rocket motors. On this particular holiday, unfortunately, the air conditioning system broke down and the building became very hot. Figuring that it was cooler outside than inside, I decided to go out and take a hike in the desert air. And I'd gone about half to three-quarters of a mile when I observed an object coming toward me from over the peaks of the Oregon Mountain. I couldn't determine much about it when I first saw it because it was after sundown and the moon hadn't come up yet. I merely saw that there was something there that was obscuring the light from the start. As I continued to watch it, it grew in size and eventually made a landing about 70 feet from where I was standing. It was completely silent in operation. I observed no jet streams, no propellers, no outward evidence of the application of the force that controlled it. This was extremely startling to me because I had been for some years engaged in the rocket and aircraft industries, and I thought I was at least reasonably familiar with all types of airframe that we were producing or attempting to produce at the time. And this, of course, bore not the least resemblance to any one of these objects. Also, it was coming down too slowly to have been supported by even the most efficient sort of airframe, which indicated that either it was a lighter-than-aircraft or whoever had built it had solved some problems of which our best physicists had only commenced to dream at that time. I almost became convinced that it was and must be a craft from someplace other than this Earth. And, understandably enough, I became considerably perturbed, not to say frightened out of my wits. Not quite out of my wits, because I didn't break into a run or anything. I remained frozen to the spot. I made all kinds of explanations, saying this was canny thinking on my part. I didn't want to attract attention to myself by breaking into a run, but perhaps the truth of the matter is that I was just scared stiff. Anyway, I didn't move. I saw it come in and touch down about 70 feet from where I was standing. I heard a very definite crackling of the brush as it settled, and this, of course, removed the last possibility that it was, in fact, a lighter-than-air craft. The object was an oblate spheroid, a sphere that is considerably flattened at the top and bottom. It was about 30 feet in diameter at the widest point and about 16 feet in height. On the ground, it had a silvery color. After observing it for some time, not knowing whether to approach it or to get out of there, I found myself approaching it a step at a time very cautiously. I walked up to within a step or two of it and then made a circle about it to see if I could see any doors, windows, or openings of any sort. I didn't see any. It was a smooth, unbroken sphere or spheroid.
In other words, you were the first man to actually have a physical contact with a flying saucer as far as the White Sands Desert was concerned. Then came the high point in UFO history, June 1952. It was a month which was swamped with amazing sightings, climaxed by the events of June 20th. On this occasion, seven blips appeared on the radar screen at Washington National Airport, and jets went aloft to identify the objects which seemed to function as aircraft. Radar observed the blips accelerate from 125 miles per hour to 500 miles per hour, turning at 90-degree angles as they went. At one point, they stopped in mid-flight and reversed the course. At another, they were clocked at speeds in excess of 7,200 miles per hour. No answer, no solution, no explanation was ever provided. On Sunday, July 7th, 1952, one Truman Bethrum claimed to have been contacted by a saucer some 300 feet in diameter. It was commanded by a gorgeous female named Aura Raines. Then on November 20th of that year, amateur astronomer George Adamski saw a saucer land, and he met the pilot of Venusian. This is George's description.
A man was up there and waving to me. So I come up to this fella, and he had a funny suit on him, sort of a ski-type suit. And I thought it was one piece. Well, later, I have learned it's two piece.
George Adamski, I wonder if you could describe this man in detail to us.
Yeah, he's a man about 5 foot, 7 to 8 inches, and I would say around 135 pounds of quite delicate hands, the tapered fingers, and beautiful, very sharp eyes, looked like they looked right through you. Sometimes you couldn't hardly tell whether he was really a man or a woman. And the long hair waving, resting on his shoulders, he kind of a halfway smile, and put his hand out to shake. And it was a palm-to-palm contact that way, and he smiled. He started telling me things, and I couldn't understand. And I finally got the idea. I wanted to know where he's from. I pointed to the sun, and I made one orbit, called it Mercury, named it, and then Venus, and then Earth, and pointed to myself and the Earth. And then I said, where are you from? He got the idea. He finally pointed to the sun, and he made one orbit, didn't say nothing. He made a second orbit, and he pointed to himself and to that orbit. Then that meant Venus. That's how I knew he was Venetian.
But he couldn't talk to you.
He could talk. He was testing my ability of receiving impressions, he told me later. So he did understand everything I said, except I didn't understand.
When you say impressions, are you referring to telepathic communication?
That's correct. All information we receive silently.
George, if you were a little doubtful, did he tell you that he was a man?
He did. But even then, I was a little bit doubtful. But you know, when nature calls, the nature calls, and that way
we established that. Well, we got over that.
While we were standing there talking, trying to get some understanding between us, I saw a flash of lights go out, and I wonder where that come from. Just like a mirror would reflect, you should know. And I looked around fast, and that's when I spotted the ship that the same ship that I photographed was hiding in this little cove. And I pointed to him, and I said, that's your ship. That's what I said. He nodded his head, and we walked all of 75 to maybe 90 feet from where we stood to this place. And that's where he finally told me to stay away from the ship, not get too close to it. It's unpowered. There was somebody else in it. You could see it. You know, shadow. Somebody else in it. But talking, I forgot all about it. And I somehow pushed over, and this arm got caught under the flange, and the magnetic force, or whatever you want to call it, pulled it up suddenly and slammed it back down. And even now, unaware, sometimes this arm goes limp. He finally went in the ship, went up this hill, see, and went up on the flange there, and there was a door in there, and he went in there, and the way she took off, she went towards his mothership that I mentioned first. Later, I have learned how they get in and out. They have hatches at the bottom, or they come out through the side, which is certain, what appear to be portholes, certain openings there. They can come right out of the side or out of the bottom. They usually return on the top like a flat top, like a carrier, and then slide in down the chute.
The second of the famous flying saucer Georges, George Van Tassel. He met a man from another planet in the following year. This visitor bore the name Sal Ganda. This is the incident as told by George Van Tassel. George, I wonder if you can tell me about the first contact that you had.
Yes, John. This occurred on August the 24th of 1953. At approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. My wife and I were sleeping out in the open in the desert because of the heat in August. I woke up and looked around, and there was a man standing there at the foot of the bed. I said, what do you want? He smiled at me and said, my name is Sal Ganda, and I would be pleased to show you our craft. After I said, what do you want, I never uttered another word during the whole course of this contact. Every time I thought of something to ask, he was answering me before I got the first sentence out.
How did he answer?
The first word. The only English I can compare to his speech was that of Ronald Coleman, who I think spoke the English language as near perfectly as anybody ever did. I tried to awaken the wife, and she seemed to be under some spell, so I got out of bed and walked with him down to the ship 100 yards away, which was a bell-shaped type of craft with portholes up near the top, and was roughly 36 feet in diameter at the rim and 19 feet high on the outside, and inside was circular with a cage in the middle through which a shaft went up into the dome from a rotor in under the deck. And as I approached this ship with this man, I became very nauseated. And this became greater as I got closer to the ship. However, after I passed underneath the ship and stepped on this spot on the ground, which had turned butter color almost, I started to rise up into the bottom of the ship. This man followed me up on an anti-gravity beam. I stepped inside, and as he walked along this wall, he appeared to snap his thumb. And I don't know whether there was a sound that he made, but seats came out of the wall and made a curved lounge. And he did the same thing on the top part of the shelf. And four doors opened with the instruments mounted on the bottom of the doors, and in the open position, placed the instruments before the portholes. And we passed behind the three men who were on the ship, who never got off. The center man apparently was controlling the ship, and the other two were standing beside him. And after we passed the crew, he again flicked his thumb up on the higher wall, and a door slid open, and in this compartment were a number of their uniforms, which appeared to be very similar. The blouse appeared to be very similar to our sweatshirts, of a very close-knit material, and the pants of a similar material, only snug around the ankles. He explained that this compartment cleaned and deodorized their clothing by a density of light process. I thought to ask him if all of their people were the same height, and before I could get the first word out, he answered.
Do you think that was a coincidence, or do you think he was reading your mind?
Well, I know he was reading my mind.
But you did not receive telepathically?
No, he spoke in the finest English I've ever heard. And then, without any further information on the clothing, he walked to a hole in the deck. He just jumped down and remarked, "Stoop so you don't hit your head." In the center of this catwalk was a big rotor turning. And on the outside of the catwalk was another rotor turning in the opposite direction. Well, I could see where these two rotors apparently were geared together underneath the catwalk in order to coordinate their speeds and counteract the torque so the ship itself wouldn't spin. And this was apparently figured out so that the mass of both were the same, and therefore there would be no torque relative to the structure. This reminded me, I mean, I got the thought at the time of Ezekiel's wheels within wheels, because you couldn't describe a planetary gear system any better than saying wheels within wheels or gears within gears. He stepped by me and climbed up through the hole, and I followed him. And then he walked over to the entry port, and he just stepped in that hole like there was something there to hold him. Well, when I got to the edge of the hole and looked down at the ground, about, I'd say, 14 feet down, I figured I was going to have to light with a normal impact of a jump from that height. So I scooted down on the edge of the hole and then just dropped in a squat position, ready to take the shock when I hit the ground, which would be normal to anybody that wasn't used to this anti-gravity beam. And then he walked back to bed with me, and he said they would return. And he walked back to the ship and apparently got aboard. The ship took off on about a 15-degree climb, and in a matter of about 7 seconds was just faded out in the distance. So that was 53.
You said that Salganda said that he would be back again. Has he ever contacted you since that time?
No.
It's possible that the most completely amazing and exciting flying saucer tales are told by the charming Orfeo Angelucci. Mr. Angelucci claimed that his original sighting was even before the Kenneth Arnold affair. It took place back in 1946. But his first contact didn't happen until 1952. However, as unbelievable as all that was, nothing compares for pure wildness with this story of Orfeo Angelucci.
I entered the door, and at the table nearest the door was a very, very handsome man. And as I approached, he says, "Greetings, Orfeo. Sit down." And I said, "You have a third glass here. Is someone with you?" He looked at the glass, and he was surprised. He said, "I don't know how that happened. I only ordered two glasses." He asked me to order. Then he asked me if I wanted a bottle of beer. I said, "No, not tonight." So he says, "Good." He lifted the pitcher of water from the table and poured it into my glass. Then he went into his pocket, and he said, "Then how about some of the best champagne in the world?" He took out a little pellet and dropped it in my glass, and it started to fizzle like his own. So he told me to call him nothing but Adam. Two months ago, he had discovered he had 9 months to live. He had cancer, and it was incurable. Anyhow, he says, "Eat up. Let's dine and just get acquainted for the time being." I noticed that his glass was filling itself with water, but no one had poured it in there. So we went on for a while, and as the dessert approached, I heard music coming from the glass. It was subdued music. He said, "Wait a minute. On this pitcher here, the water was up to this black spot. Now it's down here." He said, "But the pellet..." He went into his pocket and he says, "Wait, I'm supposed to have four." He took out the pellets and only three. He said what they were doing was sublimating the water, or evaporating it from the pitcher into the glass by remote control, and sublimated the pellet in his pocket over into the glass so that no one ever actually saw the process. Of course, I knew now that he had had either experience with space visitors or that he himself was one. And then I looked up at him and I noticed that he was looking now intently into the glass. He had a little smile on his face, yet tears were streaming down his eyes, landing right on the table before him. I thought, "God, what is it that he is going on?" And I looked at the glass, and now there was the figure of a girl dancing in it with blonde hair, a little miniature woman, just dancing to the music, and the music itself became more spirited as she danced. Never saw such dancing before. Immediately I thought, well, Adam is either recalling someone or he's had an experience out of this world, literally out of this world. When she disappeared, she never looked at me. She always looked toward him. But in the finale, when the music ended with a crash, she suddenly whirled and went on her knee and looked toward me. But she had a very grim aspect on her face, as though to say, "You don't know now, but you soon will why and what Adam is experiencing now." And with that gesture, that is when she got down on her knee, bowed like in a curtsy, and that grim look toward me, as much as to tell me, "You too will know what Adam is now experiencing someday," she completely disappeared. That was the end of the dance, and the music ceased.
You know, that to me is the wildest and most beautiful of all the stories to arise from the flying saucer phenomenon. But what of the down-to-earth, rational evaluation of UFOs, that is, unidentified flying objects? Listen to one of the most famous and respected of news commentators in the history of radio, Mr. Frank Edwards.
Why do I persist in regarding these so-called saucers as realities? Well, I do this because during the 12 years or so that I have been interested in these things, I've had reason to change my mind about them. At first, I thought they were some development of ours, and I'm sure there were a lot of other people in this country who thought that. But as the years went by and things happened, I realized, as did many other people, that these things, most of them, are nothing more than conventional objects seen under unusual circumstances and misconstrued by people who do not recognize them for what they are. But there is a small percentage of these things that simply cannot be explained away as conventional objects. And the Air Force certainly doesn't regard them as conventional objects because it has, upon occasion, issued orders to shoot them down. You don't shoot down hallucinations, and you don't shoot down atmospheric disturbances. You don't shoot down temperature inversions. These things have to be real and solid. Now, I belong to an organization called NICAP. The chairman of the board is Admiral Hillencutter. Our first one was Admiral Farney, the father of our guided missile and the man who coined the term guided missile. And he liked the rest of us on the board, and he said so publicly in his opening statement. He was convinced that these things came from somewhere in space and that they were entering our atmosphere and had been for quite a while, and that they were the work of intelligent beings and were certainly not subject to human control. And Admiral Farney said this, not exactly in those words, but that's as nearly as I can remember it. That was the gist of it. And now the chairman of the board is Admiral Hillencutter, the former head of Central Intelligence. Hillencutter was in a position to know what was going on. We also have on the board Colonel Fournet, who headed one of the Air Force saucer research projects, who certainly was in a position to know what was known as far as our official research program's concerned. So many things have happened in this field that if you are close to it and have been able to get at some of the facts in it around the carefully laid censorship plans and the plan of deception and confusion that has existed and bad reporting too, you see that there is something substantial there, although we may not know what it is or where it comes from, and we certainly do not control it. In my opinion as a newsman, and in my judgment as a newsman of 36 years experience in broadcasting alone, I feel that this could be one of the biggest news stories of all time if we can get the facts out before the public and the reality of these things and their origin, as some of us suspect the origin to be, can be confirmed. I agree with Dr. Herman Oberth and with Admiral Farney and others that these things are probably interplanetary, and that I have no idea where they come from, but I am confident, in view of all the evidence that has piled up about them, that they certainly do not originate on the Earth, but where they come from and why, I don't know. These things have been photographed, and they have been seen, and they have been tracked by radar, and the government has issued a book on how to recognize them when you see them on a radar screen, how they performed when they came over the city of Washington in numbers on the night of July 19th and 20th, 1952, and about three nights later they were back again. And then on the night of August 13th, 1952, according to this government book, which I have in my possession, there were 68 of them over Washington at one time. And the book was issued for the guidance of control tower men and other men, how to recognize the things and how to know what you were seeing when you saw them. Now, to those who haven't seen them, let me say that these things are fully as real as cosmic rays. I've never seen one of them either, but I have seen the tracks that they've made when they were photographed. I've also seen the pictures of these things when they have been photographed. And so they are at least as real as cosmic rays, and for that reason, they constitute another thing that we know exists, but which we certainly do not fully understand.
Yet always, on the other hand, we have the really unbelievable claims of men like Dan Martin.
What happened in 1955, Dan Martin?
I guess it was midnight. I was driving along a rather remote section of Texas. Suddenly, I began to tingle. So I pulled off to the side of the road. Just as I came to a stop, an object came up from behind me and on the opposite side of the road. And it came to a stop, pulled just ahead of me. The back end of the thing was just about even with my radiator. Now, this thing had very much the appearance and was about the size of a diesel railroad locomotive, possibly 50 feet long. and I could see what appeared to me to be two men through glass or windows. But I walked up to within about 4 feet, I'd say. A door opened in the stern. A lady stepped out on the ground. Now, this lady weighed around 120 pounds, maybe. She was wearing a mask. It had glasses over the eyes. Then she hooked her thumbs under this thing, and she peeled it back over her head and held it in her hand. She looked at me and smiled. Now, I know that you're going to say, oh, she was a gorgeous beauty, but I didn't say that. But she was a very nice-looking girl. And she said, hello there, Mr. Martin. She didn't say hello thee, or she didn't use any Bible term. She said, hello there, Mr. Martin. I said, hello, you. Then she told me that I would be contacted later and taken aboard a spaceship. And she told me that they were from the planet Mercury. I asked her why it was that she, being a lady, came out to talk to me when I could see that there were men aboard. Her reply was she was the only one aboard who could speak my language. Then I said to her, our scientists tell us that Mercury is so too close to the sun to afford or permit animal life, much less human life. At this, she smiled, and she said, well, you see me. Am I alive? Then she repeated that I would be contacted later, but she didn't say when, and that I would be taken aboard a spaceship. At that, the door opened exactly as it had before. The lady stepped back inside, and it took off. And in a matter of a couple of 2 or 3 seconds, it was out of sight.
Getting back to Sirius Saucer Research, the most important independent investigating agency in the world is NICAP. That is National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. It is directed by retired Major of the U.S. Marines, Donald E. Kehoe. This is Major Kehoe.
I wonder if you could tell us what the organization, NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, does. In other words, what is the interest of the organization? Why do people become members of it? And what is its purpose?
Well, Long John, the organization was created to try to get back of all the ridicule about flying saucers, to determine the facts, and to end the secrecy, which our group considered dangerous. It's composed of retired officers in all the services, airline captains, scientists, technicians, experts in various fields besides members of most of the professions, and people in all 50 states and some 30 foreign countries. We analyze reports which are sent in to us by these members, also reports which are given us off the record by members of the military services. These things are evaluated by the scientists in our advisors panel and by our board of governors.
Major Kehoe, you said that NICAP was formed with a thought in mind to end the secrecy. Has the secrecy come to a halt?
No.
And what was the actual secrecy?
Well, the secrecy is based on Air Force Regulation 200-2, which prohibits all Air Force personnel from even mentioning these things with, quote, unauthorized persons, without permission from headquarters. There is also a federal law, the Espionage Act, which is invoked by the Joint Chiefs of Staff under J-146, which prevents anybody from revealing a UFO report that's made under that order. You'll find that in most cases, people in the government or even on the airlines who have made official reports are unable to reveal these.
Do you believe, Major, that there are such things as flying saucers?
There is one type of UFO which is actually a flying saucer shape. That is the disc. Now, the Air Force itself said this back in its Project Grudge report, which they said the majority of things reported to them described disc-shaped objects which had a diameter about 10 times that of their thickness, and mm-hmm. they were capable of high speeds, accelerations, and so forth, and completely superior to anything we had. So that is essentially a saucer-shaped device. But there's also the projectile-shaped device, which is the second one most commonly seen, and that's not a saucer. But most people talk about any unidentified object. So I have accepted the fact that that there are saucer-shaped objects.
But they are unidentified
they are
at
unidentified
the present time.
As to the source, as to the purpose, and just about everything connected with them, even their propulsion. Now, we speculate about it, but we do know, or we're convinced, that they're not from any nation on Earth. Because they're
well,
far
then, in
ahead
other
of
words,
our technology.
You're implying, Major Kehoe, that evidently they are coming here from other planets.
That's right. Well, this is the conclusion of the majority of our Board of Governors and technical advisors.
And as a group, you feel that these UFOs or flying saucers are coming here or hovering over this planet, and they are coming here from other planets. Is that about it, sir?
That's correct. They've been seen, they've been pursued by jets, they've been photographed, triangulated by radar, mm-hmm. they've been paced over measured distances, they have outsped every jet that's gone after them, they engage in maneuvers that are completely impossible for anything mm-hmm. that we know. Incidentally, the Air Force itself came to this conclusion long ago in a top-secret estimate, which they have been denying ever since it leaked out, but it was confirmed by their former project chief, Captain Rupo. And the existence of that document has been confirmed in a very careful statement by Major Fournet, who was the monitor on the project. Now, when he saw it, it was still top secret, so he can't say what was in it. But he says it did exist, and the Air Force statement that it didn't is untrue.
That's about it. Oh, I don't mean that there's not a tremendous amount more. There are dozens of other sighters and contactees who could have told their stories, but obviously space doesn't permit. However, these were the top figures in the flying saucer UFO age. And whenever this time is remembered, these will be the men they talk about. These, and may I fondly hope, the man who originally introduced this incredible period to the American public. Yours truly, Long John Neville.